Now let me indicate exactly where we are in dealing with the Christian philosophy of history. We've attempted to show in this course that the question as to the meaning of history is not able to be answered within the framework of the secular thinking that poses the question. Secular thinking, though effectively posing the issue as to what history means, for various logical reasons, is not able to answer this question. This has brought us to a consideration of the Christian attitude toward history and the evidence for it. And last session, we dealt with the historical question as to whether the documentary evidence in behalf of the claims of Jesus is adequate to ground his claims. In other words, when Jesus claims to be no less than God come to earth to deal with the meaning of life, is this claim able to be justified evidentially? Last time we talked about the value of the New Testament documents as historical documents. We talked about the picture of Jesus which is contained in these documents, and we especially raised the issue as to the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The point of that presentation last time, I'll reiterate here now. You can get out from under the evidence in behalf of Jesus Christ being the person he claimed to be. You can also get out from under the evidence in behalf of his resurrection. But the only way to get out from under this historically is to dump your knowledge of the classical world and a good deal of the knowledge you have of subsequent history. Why? Because the same methods of investigation that attest the reliability of this portrait of Jesus are employed for attesting the reliability of other historical considerations. The lines of approach that we took last time were not peculiar theological lines of approach. This wasn't a matter of starting out with certain tests for the soundness of the picture of Jesus developed in theology in a circular fashion to justify what we had already begun with. What we did was to begin with the kinds of historical tests that are employed in dealing with the historicity of any document or the historicity of any event. And so excellent are these historical evidences that if a person wants to reject them, he must at the same time throw out other events and other documents which are attested by the same methods. I can't underscore this too strongly. The evidence historically for the soundness of the claims of Jesus Christ are evidences within the framework of ordinary historical investigation. Now, if you're a Christian, this shouldn't surprise you, because the Christian claim is that God really became flesh, that he actually came into the human situation, that he operated within the framework of ordinary history. Now, if that's what he did, then it would be pretty silly, wouldn't it, to talk about this as if it were an event in some hidden area that could not have any kind of attestation in the ordinary sense. The central idea of the Christian gospel is that heaven and earth come together, that God becomes man, and that these events occur in the public domain. This is not, in other words, some kind of faith operation which takes place only in the lives of those people who are willing to look at it that way. There are some Christians who might very well give you this idea, that the idea is if you feel that the Christian faith is right, if you feel that the Christian faith is the thing for you, well, fine. It would be very comfortable if it were that way, because then, of course, you wouldn't need to bother with it unless you felt that way. But Christianity isn't that sort of thing. Christianity makes certain claims as to its truth and bases these claims as to its truth on evidence which is there whether you like it or not. And it follows, therefore, that what you do with it is going to have an objective effect whether you like it or not. The Christian faith, therefore, doesn't come to you begging for a warm acceptance. The Christian faith comes to you as true, and it says, what you do with Jesus Christ is going to have an effect regardless of what you think. And the question is simply whether the effect is going to be positive or whether it's going to be negative. There is absolutely no neutrality. At the point of the cross of Christ, the ways divide, and a person either decides to go with it or he decides to go against it. A person who thinks that he can be neutral or indifferent at this point is as silly as the person who thinks he can be neutral or indifferent with regard to the law of gravitation. It really doesn't make much difference how you feel. If you disregard the law of gravitation, you're in big trouble. The Christian faith is presented in those terms. Let me remind you of the quotation which I passed out, which you probably have with you, from Sir Frederick Kenyon, Recent Developments in the Textual Criticism of the Greek Bible. This work, which is a classic, came out as long ago as 1933, and Kenyon actually increased the intensity of his assertions on the basis of the papyrus evidence that appeared between 1933 and the time of his death in the 1940s. Let me read this quotation as a kind of summary of the emphasis that we took in the last period. Says Kenyon, quote, "All this repeated mention of divergent manuscripts and families of texts, in reference to the New Testament, may perhaps give the impression that the text of the New Testament is abnormally uncertain. Such an impression can best be corrected by an attempt to envisage the early history of the text and its present condition. So far from the New Testament text being in an abnormally unsatisfactory state, as is claimed by some, it is far better attested than that of any other work of ancient literature. Its problems and difficulties arise not from a deficiency of evidence, but from an excess of it. In the case of no work of Greek or Latin literature do we possess manuscripts so plentiful in number or so near the date of composition. Apart from Virgil, of whom we have manuscripts written some 300 or 400 years after the poet's death, the normal position with regard to the great works of classical literature is that our knowledge of their text depends upon a few, or at most a few dozen manuscripts, of which the earliest may be of the 9th or 10th or 11th century, but most of the 15th, after the beginning of the Renaissance when the copying was carried on and the discovery of manuscripts was engaged in especially. In these conditions, it generally happens that scientific criticism has suggested one manuscript, usually but not necessarily the oldest, as the principal authority, and has based our printed texts on this, with some assistance from the later and inferior manuscripts and a liberal use of conjecture. In a critical apparatus, there's nothing more common than the abbreviation CJ. CJ means editorial conjecture. This is the way we hope it was. Kenyon continues, "In the case of the New Testament, the vellum manuscripts are far earlier and far more numerous. The gap between the earliest of them and the date of composition of the books is smaller, and a larger number of papyri have, especially since the discovery of the Chester Beatty papyri, given us better means of bridging the gap. We are far better equipped to observe the early stages of textual history in the manuscript period in the case of the New Testament than of any other work of ancient literature." This is Sir Frederick Kenyon, the principal librarian of the British Museum and one of the foremost authorities on textual criticism. Summing this up, when St. Paul found himself before King Agrippa, called on the carpet for engaging in the proclamation of the Christian faith, King Agrippa said, "Much learning doth make thee mad." This is the standard comment of the politician to the intellectual, you know, in any period. And Paul replied, "King Agrippa, you know that these things are true, for they were not done in a corner." Now that's precisely the Christian claim. These things were not done historically in a closet somewhere, available only to some kind of special procedure which the lucky believers have and the unlucky believers don't. Unlucky unbelievers don't. The evidence for the soundness of the claims of Christ to being God come to earth and to knowing what history means and to what human life means, these claims are grounded directly in general historical evidence. Well, why then are these claims not readily accepted? One of the major reasons has to do with the miraculous, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But before I deal with that, I want to talk about another reason very briefly why people don't go along with this historical evidence. When it comes to religion, people sometimes say, I will not accept this unless I have 100% certainty. I've got to have 100% proof. And the evidence for Jesus Christ being the person he said he was is obviously not 100% evidence. This is historical evidence, and I can conceive of this going in some other direction. It can't be emphasized too strongly that when a person demands 100% evidence for something, he doesn't realize that the only things, in quotes, for which 100% evidence is possible are not things at all. That is to say, 100% certainty is possible only in the realm of pure definition. In the field of pure logic or pure mathematics, you can have 100% certainty. Why? Because you define the certainty into the system axiomatically at the beginning. You begin with the axioms of good old Euclid's geometry, for example. Or you begin with the axioms of Whitehead and Russell's Principia Mathematica. And on the basis of these axioms, you can develop the entire system of geometry on the one hand, or logic and mathematics on the other. How do you prove something in these areas? You prove something by relating your particular argument to the axioms that you have accepted by definition to begin with. The QED that goes into the geometrical proof, or the QEF for a construct in geometry, does not mean that evidence has been collected. What it means is that you have been able to tie your particular proof to the axioms you accepted at the beginning. This is, of course, 100% certainty. But this does not necessarily tell you what the world consists of. Anytime you want to find out what the world consists of, you've got to check evidence. And the checking of evidence does not reach 100%. It's always conceivable that new observations could alter the picture. This, however, does not immobilize us when it comes to acting. If it did, we would be totally immobilized. For example, you don't have 100% certainty that it's actually your girlfriend sitting next to you. It may be that she is such a cleverly disguised Martian that you never notice the difference. That possibility is not of such a nature that to accept it would involve a logical contradiction or anything of that kind. You can conceive of the universe in any number of ways other than it actually is. How then do we act? We act by checking the evidence out in behalf of a particular issue. We see how the evidence stacks up, and then we act. And we cannot sit on the fence in situations like this because the evidence does not sit on the fence. Evidence either pushes us in one direction or it pushes us in another. We may reserve judgment if there is a good reason to think that more evidence is going to arise bearing directly upon the subject, but where there are no such expectations, then it behooves us to act. And faith is involved in all actions of this kind. I've illustrated several times the case of the person crossing the street. When you check the traffic that is crossing in the street, you do not have 100% certainty that you're not going to be run down. All of you have seen the Roadrunner cartoons. It's always possible, no matter how carefully you look, to be completely smashed by the vehicle or being who comes along much faster than you realize. On the other hand, we do not spend our lives on one side of the street. We check the evidence. If the evidence is good enough, we cross the street. And when we cross it, we do not take the percentage of ourselves corresponding to the probabilities across, leaving the rest of us behind. We take all of us, 100% of us across, even if the evidence is only 80%, and the evidence is getting less every day that goes by. There is more faith involved in crossing the street as every day goes by. Faith, in this sense, jumps the gap between plausibility, evidential probability, and certainty. We do this in all areas of life. And if we demand in the area of religion that we have 100% certainty, what we're doing, of course, is saying the area of religion will not be considered as an area of fact. The area of religion will have to be considered as a matter of definition. But good heavens, no religious claim worth its salt considers itself definitional. Religious claims have to do with matters of fact. The God that religion talks about is an existent being. As such, either there is evidence in his behalf or there isn't. Thus, the fact that the evidence for a religious claim is not in the area of completely formal 100% certainty is of no consequence at all. Nothing else is, except those areas that are areas of straight definition. If a person demands of the claim of Christianity a 100% level of certainty, it behooves the person to explain why he places this demand on it. And the answer has got to be that he will not regard the Christian claims as factual claims. The minute they are considered factual claims, they enter into the realm of evidence and must be checked out on that ground. This is one of the reasons why people don't go along with the claims of Christianity, because they demand 100% level of certainty. And tied closely to this is a peculiar selectivity in making demands. For example, when many people begin to look at the evidence for the validity of Jesus' claims, as we talked about this evidence last time, they say, now wait a minute, it could have been otherwise, couldn't it? And the answer is, sure it could have been otherwise. But when they deal with Napoleon, and the evidence seems to be very powerful that he lost the Battle of Waterloo and did not win it, it's very rare that the same person will say, well, couldn't the evidence be off the track, and couldn't he actually have won? Sure, it's possible. Anything is possible in a contingent universe except squeezing toothpaste back into a tube, as one philosopher has said. People, however, suddenly begin to open up the area to all kinds of bizarre possibilities for which there is no evidence in the case of the claims of Christ, but when it comes to other parallel claims, they don't. Why? That's the interesting question. And if you analyze this very closely, you discover that they are threatened by the one and they are not threatened by the other. Whether Napoleon won or lost the Battle of Waterloo is relatively unimportant for your existence. But whether Jesus Christ rose from the dead or not is extremely important, because if he did, he's got a claim on your life, and your life can't rest in neutrality any longer. People sense this, and for this reason, when they come up against this kind of evidence, they say, wait a minute, hold on. Notice, though, that the effect of something, the effect of it, that is, whether you have to act on it or not, is not relevant to the question as to whether it's true. There are many things in history which are true that have very little effect on you. There are also many things in history that have a great deal of effect on you potentially, and the truth of which needs to be investigated regardless of the consequences. I wish that I could shove under the rug the atrocities of the Second World War. I wish, as a historian describing the Second World War, I didn't have to face that kind of evidence. That forces me to a particular view of human nature, which I might be able to get away from otherwise. But if those events happened, they happened. And I've got to take the evidence for them, first of all, and deal with the events in terms of evidence, and then afterwards ask the question of the effect on me personally. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people around these days who say, first of all, what's it going to do to me? And then if it's going to do something I don't like, it didn't really happen. Said Pascal, there is enough evidence for the truth of Christianity to convince anyone who is willing, but there is not enough evidence to force into the Christian faith a person who refuses. And Pascal very clearly saw the nature of the evidence, the kind of evidence involved here. The evidence is sufficient to carry you along unless you insist upon not having your life changed. If you insist upon not having your life changed, sure you can find some way out of this. But isn't it interesting that you don't seek that way out in the case of other comparable evidential situations? Now finally, we come down to this issue of the miraculous. There are people who say, all right, the evidence looks great. Fine historical documents there. Primary source witnesses observing the events. They are neither drunk nor insane. They seem to be able to tell the difference between white and black and between things that happen and things that don't. There's just one little difficulty. They record miracles in these documents. And indeed, they center the case, evidently, on the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Under those circumstances, the whole shebang goes out. We don't need to consider it seriously, and the reason is that miracles just don't happen. This kind of approach at least has the merit of being clean-cut. One sees exactly where one is. You may be interested in a brief recounting of two encounters that I've had with the head of the philosophy department here, Professor Stroll. One of them in Canada back in 1963, and one of them here on the campus when I addressed his class earlier this term. In 1963, Professor Stroll delivered a lecture attempting to show that the historical evidence for Christianity was inadequate, that it could not ground the picture of Jesus. This was given as a philosophy club lecture, and as you know, if you have the book Where Is History Going, I replied to this argument in lectures given at the University of British Columbia. After I had gone through all of this evidence, in the course of three lectures, I had a little session with Professor Stroll in the philosophy department office, and we went back over this evidence. And finally, at the end of it, he said, "All right, Montgomery, it's damn good evidence, but miracles just don't happen." Now, it would have saved everybody a great deal of work, it would have saved me a lot of labor, a lot of research and proofreading and all kinds of messy academic activities if, instead of presenting the original lecture, Professor Stroll had simply gotten up and declared that miracles don't happen. Because really, the issue was not a historical issue for him. And when I gave my lecture in his class and we talked a bit afterwards, we got right back onto the same thing. There I dealt with the documentary value of the Old Testament in terms of the origins of the Pentateuchal material. And instead of staying on this, we inevitably got over to the other question, which was, how could the miracles recorded there really have occurred? Those miracles could not have occurred, and therefore, these materials must be suspect. This is the issue that we want to talk about tonight. What about the issue of the miraculous? This gets us, of course, into a philosophical question, because the person who objects to the miraculous will not allow the historical evidence to decide the question. There is philosophical reason prior to the historical evidence, or apart from the historical evidence, that will carry the argument and will eliminate the possibility of these documents being sound. The classic criticism of miracles comes, as many of you know, in the writings of David Hume, the philosopher David Hume. And you will find that Hume's arguments dealing with the miraculous are presented and represented in various guises from Hume's time right on to the present. Virtually all of the arguments against the miraculous derive in some way from Hume's argument. We're going to be talking about Hume's argument a bit, and then we're going to talk about a kind of statistical refinement of this argument, which is often presented at the present time. I'm very much convinced that Hume's argument against the miraculous ought to be included in elementary philosophy texts, but it should be included in a different section from the one that is normally used. Normally, the argument is included in the section on philosophy of religion to show that miracles don't occur, and therefore religious claims based upon miracles don't have to be taken seriously. The argument should be included in the book, but it should be included at an earlier point in the section on logic, because the argument happens to be one of the most gorgeous examples of circular reasoning that has probably ever come about. Let's look at the argument. If you have the mimeograph, the quest for absolutes. Is that a mimeograph that people have in this course? Yes. If you have the mimeograph, the quest for absolutes, will you turn in that mimeograph to page 7? And if you don't have that and you are wandering about in the shape of the past, this is also included in the shape of the past. Maybe somebody can give me a quick page reference. I haven't read the book recently, actually. It's in, you can get it by the index. I can't, huh? Yes, quite a few index references. Page 290. Page 290. You're working with the shape of the past. This is a quotation from Hume's Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. It is a direct quotation. Quote, "A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. Why is it more than probable that all men must die? That lead cannot of itself remain suspended in air? That fire consumes wood and is extinguished by water? Unless it be that these events are found agreeable to the laws of nature, and there is required a violation of these laws, or in other words, a miracle to prevent them. Nothing is esteemed a miracle if it ever happens in the common course of nature. It is no miracle that a man seemingly in good health should die on a sudden, because such a kind of death, though more unusual than any other, has yet been frequently observed to happen. But it is a miracle that a dead man should come to life, because that has never been observed in any age or country. There must, therefore, be a uniform experience against every miraculous event. Otherwise, the event would not merit that appellation. And as a uniform experience amounts to a proof, there is here a direct and full proof from the nature of the fact against the existence of any miracle. Nor can such a proof be destroyed, or the miracle rendered incredible by an opposite proof, which is superior. The plain consequence is, and it is a general maxim worthy of our attention, and this is the famous Humean maxim on miracles, that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. And even in that case, there is a mutual destruction of arguments, and the superior only gives us an assurance suitable to that degree of force which remains after deducting the inferior." Now he illustrates. "When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or the fact which he relates should really have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision, and always reject the greater miracle. If the falsehood of his testimony would be more miraculous than the event which he relates, then and not till then can he pretend to command my belief or opinion." Now the idea here is that there is uniform experience against the miraculous, and that's what we mean by the laws of nature. The laws of nature are the product of uniform experience. And since there is uniform experience against the miraculous, if anybody comes along and says a miracle has occurred, why, it would be more miraculous if he weren't mistaken than that the miracle occurs. Thus, miracles are done. Notice that this is an entirely a priori form of reasoning. It makes it unnecessary ever to investigate a miracle claim. This, of course, is beautiful. It eliminates all kinds of messy documentary questions. You're able simply to sit in your living room and contemplate the nature of the universe, and on the basis of this contemplation, it becomes unnecessary to check any evidence. Any miracle claim, any instance of anybody coming along and saying a miracle occurred, you simply don't have to go any farther with, because it would be more miraculous for the bird actually to be telling the truth than it would be for the miracle itself to have taken place. Now look at this argument very closely. Why is it that it is always more of a miracle for somebody to be telling the truth about an alleged miracle than for the miracle to have occurred. Why is it that in weighing the testimony for a miracle and the fact of the miracle, you can always get rid of that? Why? Because this situation is grounded in uniform experience against the miraculous. Uniform experience. Experience has shown that there are no miracles. And on the basis of this, the laws of nature are established. The little problem with this is, how did we get uniform experience against the miraculous in the first place? Experience means going out and checking things, generally. Eh? By observing the world, we get certain judgments as to what happens and what doesn't. Says Hume, we have uniform experience against the miraculous. But great day in the morning. In order to arrive at that conclusion, he has to check the testimonies of people as to what occurs. And among these testimonies are claims to the miraculous. You see why the thing is circular reasoning? At this point, the testimony is ruled out. But in ruling out the testimony, he rules out the possibility of even talking about experience. This becomes quite clear in the argument when you see his illustration. Why is it, get this here, it is a miracle that a dead man should come to life. Why? Because that has never been observed in any age or country. See? In other words, there's uniform experience against people rising from the dead. Never in any country has such a thing been observed. Therefore, when someone comes along and says, I've seen someone rise from the dead, of course you can rule it out. But great heavens, that's exactly the kind of testimony that's needed to determine what the experience says. The way to find out what's going on in the world is to check observations. And what you find here, of course, is not uniform experience. What you find is a great diversity of experience. You find many people observing others who have died and stayed dead. But you also find historical evidence, primary source evidence, in behalf of somebody dying and not staying dead. Now this means that experience must indeed determine the show. But that experience does not rule out the miraculous. It's that experience, in fact, that makes it necessary to consider the miraculous. The experience over here consists of a number of observations. A, B, C, D, E. Now, let us say that these observations here are of people who have died and stayed dead. Along comes observer X, who claims that he has seen someone die and rise again. The only proper inductive scientific procedure is to take all of this evidence and on the basis of all of it, develop, in quotes, your laws of nature. The laws of nature are nothing more than generalizations on the basis of experience. Therefore, if you want to formulate a law of nature on this subject, let me suggest this one. Assuming that there is enough evidence for claim X, the law of nature can be something like this. In general, people die and stay dead, footnote, with one very important exception. And both the generalization and the exception are grounded in experience, in evidence. The problem that Hume had was that he imbibed too much of the absolutistic view of natural law, which existed very widely in the 18th century. He got the idea that natural laws were somehow firmly established so that experience could not in any way alter them. But in reality, experience is the very grounding of our laws of nature. Laws of nature are really nothing more than our generalizations. We don't find them written on the sky and then copy them down and they're never changed. The laws of nature, the laws of physics, the laws of in the various scientific fields are the product of our observations. And therefore, the scientific method is to check the observations. Otherwise, look at the situation we get into. We allow the uniformity, in quotes, of our immediate experience to rule out unique events outside of that experience. I illustrate in my book and in this mimeograph with Gulliver arriving at the island of Lilliput. There is Gulliver, he wakes up, and there are these 8-inch tall little people tying him down. Now, Gulliver has had, in his own personal experience, a uniform experience against people being 8 inches tall. People are always at least 4 feet tall or something of this kind as adults. All right, Gulliver wakes up, and unfortunately he has been reading Hume just before the shipwreck. He wakes up and there are these little 8-inch high characters tying him down. Gulliver refuses to believe that they're there. Now the little fellows say, but look, here we are, we're tying you down. You see, we're actually here. Gulliver says, ah, don't give me that. It would be more miraculous for me to be observing you as you actually are than for this alleged miracle to occur. Therefore, I must conclude, regardless of the experiential evidence, that I am deceived. You see what's happened? An a priori, a presupposition, not based upon experience, has been allowed so to color the situation that it becomes impossible for any facts to mean anything. Or it's like the old farmer that I cited in another class period when we were talking about the nature of time, who saw a giraffe for the first time, and he looked at the giraffe, and he looked twice, and he said, there ain't no such animal. His experience thus far had been with short-necked creatures, and therefore he concluded that this thing couldn't be there. Now, the proper approach to take would have been to enlarge his generalization, to include this long-necked creature. And the proper approach here is to enlarge one's generalization about people dying and staying dead, if that's the problem we're dealing with, so that it does take into account the evidence. Incidentally, a book has just been published, which I have here somewhere, which has the shortest refutation of Hume that I've ever seen. This argument is quite correct, and since it's so short, I'm going to read it to you. I can find it. It's one sentence. One sentence of an appendix. Here we are, miracles. This is in the book The Logic of Gospel Criticism by Humphrey Palmer, which is published by Macmillan. This is a very recent work and a very important work analyzing logically what's going on in a great deal of biblical criticism today. And the conclusion of Humphrey Palmer, who is a philosopher, is that most people engaging in biblical criticism today think that they're being scientific, but in point of fact, they are violating logical canons all over the place. They're attempting to reconstruct documents on the basis of evidence that in principle is not there, and all kinds of interesting things of this sort. Anyway, in the appendix to this, we have miracles and doctrine. And here we have, actually this is three sentences long. Thus, this on Hume, quote, Hume urged that as miracles are at best occasional, the evidence for them could never outweigh our constant experience of their not happening. This argument either makes all exceptions to any rule incredible, or else it relies on a tendentious definition of miracles as what can't happen. It could also be replied that present evidence cannot disprove past happening. And that's all that Humphrey Palmer bothers with, and this is quite right. Hume's argument does one of those two things. Either it eliminates any exceptions to any rule, which is an obvious absurdity, or it relies on a tendentious definition of miracles as what can't happen. In other words, it eliminates miracles simply by definition. There is, however, a statistical variant on this argument, which I want to talk about for a minute, because it is common
in certain circles.
And the argument goes like this. But wait a minute. If we have all of these people, A through N, observing people dying and staying dead, then surely this builds up a weight of probability against this observer who says that a person died and didn't stay dead. Surely all of this creates a weight so heavy that when these two are put into balance, the evidence over here outweighs the evidence over here. Statistically, there are so many more instances of events occurring along, in quotes, regular lines, that when you come across something like this, the statistics make it unnecessary to investigate the particular event over here. This sounds even more appealing, perhaps, than Hume, because of the fact that it employs a wee bit of statistics. But if you look at this carefully, you see that it's nothing but a restatement of what we were just talking about. If I ever survive all of this stuff, it'll be a miracle, yes. right. Anyway, if we look at this, in comparison with this, we find that it's really doing the same thing. What gives the person who argues this the idea that what you have over here has a necessary bearing on what goes on over here? You see, in order to put these two into relation, it's necessary to assume, first of all, that they all take place within the same universe, that A through N and X are all part of the same structure. Since they're all part of the same structure, you can use this to deal with this. But that also begs the question. You see, the point here is that X is not part of the structure. The claim here is that somebody has come alive again, which is qualitatively different from not coming alive. Now, under those circumstances, to say that all of these events here can bear down on this event here is to assume already that they are all tied together and are similar. That's exactly the question. Are they similar or aren't they? You see, this is just a statistical way of eliminating exceptions to any rule. All you've got to do is to have enough instances of following the rule over here, and by George, you can eliminate any necessity of checking exceptions. And the result of this is that you eliminate any scientific investigation, and it then becomes a matter simply of taking your generalizations and allowing them to rule the show.